Hello, Jeremy here from Jackie Winter. In case you missed it on Instagram, we're doing a bit of a bribe slash giveaway here. In a few weeks' time, we're going to be announcing the latest addition to our new blank document printing services, which is part of our gallery, Lamington Drive, the first and only A2 risograph machine in Australia. We got big plans for this, but straight off the bat, we have an amazing two-color art print done by none other than our resident artist, Lachlan Kahn. The image, which features a Zen garden with a special hidden message, was created exclusively for Jackie Winter Gives You the Business listeners. Now, if you want a free copy, free, mailed to you anywhere in the world, all you have to do is leave us a rating and review on iTunes. This is a straight up bribe. Make no bones about it. Send us a screen grab showing your draft review and then a second screen grab of the post-it review. And then you can email it to us at podcast@jackiewinter.com, or you can DM us on Instagram at Jackie Winter, along with your postal address. And then Bob's your uncle. You'll have this bad boy in your hot little hands in no time. Posters are limited to the first 50 responders. We'll let you know when we hit that number. For more details, check out our Instagram post announcing the giveaway at instagram.com/JackieWinter. That's Jackie with a Y, winter like the season, at Jackie Winter. Again, free poster, bribe, do it. Thank you very much. Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremham.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. Each week, our two offices come together to celebrate the people and processes that operate behind the scenes to make creative work happen, as well as some of the thoughts and tools that are shaping our industry. While we have a certain focus on advertising, illustration, and animation, the topics and ideas discussed here will hopefully be of universal value to anyone who creates anything at all. This podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as a bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, the internet brings random strangers together again as we invite one of our internet crushes, Natalie Semchuk, to the podcast. Natalie is a digital project manager and the author of one of our favorite and actually read newsletters, DPM-ish, and also the author of the amazingly hilarious Tumblr, Project Manager Reactions. We'll be talking about all things digital project management with Natalie, and there is a lot to talk about. But first, how is everyone going today? Lara, how are you?
Hot.
We're still hot.
It's like 4 billion degrees.
It really is.
It's all right, though. I'm just complaining.
You won't be complaining when you're in Hawaii.
Hawaii.
This time next week.
Yeah, because it's okay to be hot when you are
on the beach,
lounging by the pool, swimming up to the swim-up bar. I'm excited. But yeah, when you have to get the, you know, two trains and walk between the trains and come to the office or whatever, then yeah, I think it's totally fine to complain about the heat.
And you can't pay for food in beads.
You can pay for food in beads?
Well, like Club Med when I grew up, like going to vacation.
I'm not going to Club Med.
I know, but it's so cool. You still pay for food in beads.
Bianca, how are you?
I am wonderful, but I was just about to say that it's probably freezing here, but it's still hot on the train. So yeah, that's, you know, you deal with that anyway.
It's always hot on the subway.
But you're keeping warm from all the fires and the riots in Philadelphia.
Oh, yes.
Partaking in, right?
Riding hard.
Excellent. Well, we're going to get started with some of the mini topics I've been going through our Slack professional development channel. First up is a link that Bianca posted from a industry news site that we read called Little Black Book. And this is something that has been very topical of late. And I'm looking forward to chatting about this with Natalie as well. But it's a little article from one of the founders of Jelly, which is an animation illustration studio kind of based in the UK, kind of a very similar model to what Jackie Winter does. And this is kind of a whole, I guess, op-ed from one of the founders there, all about kind of IP and animation work. And this is something that I think we're really kind of coming up against at the moment in terms of how we deal with licensing for original creative content, and specifically with animation and broadcast work. So dealing with usage is something that we're very familiar with illustration, but when we've kind of now moved that into animation, whether it's through a GiftHorse or a Flutter branch, you know, that's meeting a bit of, I think, resistance.
A culture clash, maybe.
Yeah, definitely a culture clash. I mean, yeah, B, you have a lot more experience like working in an animation studio. Can you just give us a bit of a top line of what happened here in this article?
Well, yeah, I guess the article is talking about the muddy waters where there isn't really an industry standard on how you price usage for animation. You know, with illustration and with photography, the usage is tied to the medium. when you kind of move more into live action, or even graphic design, which is, I guess, a different beast altogether. Most people are working more under a work for hire contract, or the rights are sort of baked into the overall project fee just because the costs are so high. So I think animation is kind of in that sort of weird spot in between, where you are relying on artists to inform the look and feel, but it also sort of runs in a similar way to a TVC production. And yeah, I guess it is a bit of a newer medium.
It's so tricky as well, because there's so much animation and motion graphics often revolve around kind of characters as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge area where, you know, IP kind of does need to be kind of managed and managed properly. And especially, you know, budgets are not the same as they were for broadcast or online as well, because of all of the fragmentation in the medium that we've been talking about. Look, I think this is really great to have a perspective actually kind of, talked about online. We talked about in our last episode when we were talking about, the Margaret Atwood Handmaid's Tale, copyright issues, that this is something that we are very close to. We're working on our own kind of industry site called Use It or Lose It. And this is going to be some of a taste of the resources that we're hoping to kind of put out there to create a bigger discussion there. But yeah.
Because that's the problem a lot of the time, is that, everyone's having these discussions behind closed doors and it's not an open thing. So it's incredibly hard to figure out what is that industry standard and what are people expecting?
Exactly. B, you posted a link to something that you are very kind of passionate about and talk a lot about. This is an article from The Times on it's time for Apple to build a less addictive iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, we joke a lot. I mean, you've kind of said that I should buy like almost like a safe to put my iPhone in when I go to bed at night, because, you know, I'll wake
up. Not a joke.
Yeah, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and just get into like an Instagram hole. But I think it's interesting that this discussion has come up with some of these big tech companies and talking about the ethics and where their responsibility lies in the kind of products that they make. And this article, I mean, it kind of says everything that we already know. You know, iPhones are addictive, and there's obviously a lot of these platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, YouTube, make money from your attention. But I guess this article is kind of like a cry for help to Apple, who are perhaps in the best position out of anyone in tech to actually address this problem, as their business model doesn't actually depend on tech addiction. I mean, they do make a lot of money from selling premium devices at high profit margins, but obviously they are relying on the apps that are incredibly addictive to actually sell their products. So I don't know, it's a bit of an ethical dilemma, and I'm curious to see how maybe it is.
It's a really interesting read, this one.
I like it because it's also a really good, it's a very short article. You can read it very quickly to kind of get, just your head around it. I think, though, a great companion piece to this is the recent episode from the Crack podcast. Actually, the Crack podcast is something that you put me on to be, and it kind of looks really, not great from a superficial point, but when you dig into some of the episodes, they're great. And they all talk about really the mental health kind of aspects of this, where, you know, with physical health, you have kind of feedback from your body when you're putting things into your body that aren't good for you, and that's immediate. But with mental health, it's not, you don't get that immediate feedback mentally, when you are kind of engaging in this activity that might not be very kind of healthy for you. And we're just kind of on the cusp of learning how to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's similar to like alcohol addiction versus maybe food addiction. Like, it's, you can abstain from alcohol, but you need food to live. And I think it's similar, because technology, you definitely need it in this environment and the kind of time that we live in right now. So how do we best manage that? And I guess whose responsibility is it to try and work it out?
Yeah, I find interesting as well that, like, obviously the issue has long been that, yes, this is something that a lot of people care about, but it wasn't in the economic interests of companies like Apple to work, you know, towards eliminating this kind of addictive technology, but or lessening it in some way. But I think the more and more that it becomes an issue, as it is, it actually does fall into their economic interest. I mean, like,
oh man, yeah,
that's the thing that's interesting.
We're going to come back to this, I think, in one of our longer mini link episodes. But before we get there, Lara, what was your pick of the week?
My pick of the week was an article from Fast Company, Jeremy's most favorite place on the internet. And this is just a little bit of a follow on of one of the links we had last episode, which is it's titled "Radio Public Has a Big Plan to Help Small Podcasters Make Money." And so we were talking about last week how, Apple released its analytics, and finally we were able to see sort of the engagement levels of podcast listeners, and that it luckily sort of turned out to be this holy grail that people were hoping for. People are super, super engaged and loyal. And so now sort of Radio Public, and I'm sure other people as well, are starting to look at ways to help not just the sort of big name podcasts make money, but also smaller podcasts like, well, like maybe us, people who don't sort of benefit from the lucrative ad dollars of Squarespace or MailChimp or whatever it might be. And so the idea is that you could sort of sign up and they would basically place ads to bookend your podcast and you would receive money based on listens. So they have this whole plan supposedly to like, also, you know, podcasters could make the episodes ad free by paying directly to the podcast or whatever it might be, but we'll see. But I still think it's an interesting idea, and I'm kind of surprised that this sort of thing hasn't been sort of more ubiquitous.
Yeah, Laura, that is very interesting, and I think there's a lot happening in that space. We will put the link to that article and everything else we've discussed here in our show notes, which you can view every week at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. You can also subscribe to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter, and I think we'll move on from there. Mid last year, when we were just scrappy podcast upstarts, we came across a phenomenal email newsletter called DPM-ish, an incredible weekly mailout of links and editorials specifically geared towards DPMs or digital project managers. Much like hearing Morrissey for the first time when I was 13, I immediately thought, wow, someone really gets me. While we started brainstorming a list of dream interview guests for this year, the creator of DPM-ish, along with the amazingly hilarious and on-point Tumblr PM Reactions, Natalie Semchuk, was at the top of our list. But who was this mysterious person who was location agnostic with the photo of a lone cat on her about page? Well, we're delighted to answer all these questions today and more as we welcome Natalie to the podcast to talk all about her life as a digital project manager and how her skills and training can be applied to creative producers of all stripes and mediums. Natalie, welcome to the podcast. Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. That's just so great to hear that people are such big fans of the newsletter. It makes my day.
Oh my God, I love the newsletter. It's so good. When did you start it and why?
I actually noticed I'm coming up on a year. I started it last March. I had actually hit a point in my freelance where I was between several clients. A few contracts ended early. Another couldn't afford to keep me on. And I suddenly had a lot of free time. And I'd wanted to start a newsletter for a while. And I was really interested in sort of tackling project management in a very not typical way. So kind of thinking about the human aspect of what we do in sort of the situation where you are managing a project, whether you're a project manager or not, and how all this stuff with responsibility in tech and cognitive bias and things like that, how that all might affect the work that we do.
And yeah, it's interesting because before I read your newsletter, I'd never heard of the term kind of DPM. And through your newsletter, it's kind of really opened me up to what a huge community it is and how broad it is and how many different industries it kind of spans. So I'm, you know, really inspired by, you know, all of the writing that you do. You talk so much about it online. I'm really kind of curious as your background, were there kind of hints of a future PM in the making, you know, when you were kind of younger or kind of doing your studies? Have you always had this kind of passion? And tell us a bit more kind of how you actually kind of came into this role.
Yeah. I think if you ask my parents or my younger sister, they'll tell you I've always been fairly bossy. Not sure if that's a compliment, but I definitely have always enjoyed talking, communicating, sort of organizing things, making sense of the chaos. And I found that a lot of people tend to get into project management in kind of the weirdest of ways. So I initially went to school for graphic design and got my master's degree in like science and policy study. So sort of the article you were talking about, you know, responsibility with the iPhone and things like that. That's actually something I would have like studied in college and I'm really passionate about. But I decided to pursue graphic design, but ended up at a place where they only had a project management position available. And I found I really enjoyed that sort of the mix of being in the know on all sides, you know, client, team, budget, timeline, all of that, and then being able to sort of translate between everyone, the best way to get a job done, I felt I was really capable of that communication, and I really enjoy it.
It seems like that's such a similar kind of pathway. Like, nobody goes to school for this. It's like everyone is either a disgruntled creative or kind of finds it in kind of this really kind of roundabout way. Do you think that there's new pathways or other kind of pathways to get into project management at the moment? Or do you still kind of think there's like you have to kind of get into it, from the back door in a way?
I think that largely that kind of weird backdoor path is where most of the people in it now got into project management, or how they're maybe still getting there. But I have heard there are a lot of PM sort of training courses and classes out there. A friend of mine runs PM apprenticeship out of Vancouver, but they do it remotely with apprentices everywhere. And I know there are a few global project managers who have followed that path from school. I met at a conference in London last year. So I think it's starting to really diversify, which is kind of cool.
So as a project manager, I mean, your role obviously is to sort of wrangle all of these people and get them to continue doing what it is they need to be doing. So what's it like to be doing that remotely?
It's not as different as it is in person. I actually feel like I get more like peace and quiet this way. But
I can imagine.
It's a lot more deliberate though. So, you know, a lot of times you can pick up on things through body language or seeing how busy someone might be at their desk, you know, or in meetings, something like that. I definitely don't get that aspect since I'm remote. I might be seeing someone over chat, but you sort of learn to pick up on cues from people based on how much they type, how little they type, how long it takes for them to answer. And I found that the communication that I do have with my teams is a lot more meaningful in that way. So I'm a lot more deliberate in reaching out to people via chat, getting to know them, having meetings, especially, you know, we don't really have those drop by a desk like interactions anymore. It's more someone has realized they have questions and we need to meet versus, you know, taking care of it over email. So it's definitely refined that practice a little.
Let's take a step back. Can you tell us a bit more about, you know, what you're working on at the moment or kind of, I know you just recently kind of started a new job, but what kind of projects and products have you kind of worked on and what kind of teams are you kind of working with specifically?
So I typically work on web development and design projects. Sometimes that means web apps. Sometimes that just means a marketing website. Sometimes that's a little more complex, like some sort of portal or internal use custom area on a website. So typically web-driven, sometimes there are mobile components. So I'll work with, when I was freelancing, I worked with a lot of small to medium-sized agencies who were digital-focused. A lot of strategy, design, and branding work might have come along with that. Or I would work with smaller teams within a really large organization who are maintaining like a really complex site for themselves or need to put out a new feature. So pretty typical to have that connection with a web design and dev focused team.
So, I mean, you've freelanced for the last couple of years, and I imagine it must be essentially as a consultant, and I imagine it must be challenging to step into a new team or into a new environment or into a new project. How do you quickly get your bearings when you're constantly dealing with a new thing?
It took me a while, to be honest. It's hard. And I'm sure anyone who's jumped into any sort of project or even work culture that's well established can relate. It helps a lot for me to just never be afraid to ask questions. I don't care how stupid I might seem or, you know, if it seems like I might be missing something, it's totally worth asking questions all the time and bringing attention to that gap in knowledge and, you know, not making any assumptions. And I found it really helpful to sort of get everyone's side of the story, whether that's like what work has been done so far, what's spec'd out, what issues might remain on a project, what sort of the take is on the project, and getting that perspective from everyone helps me learn a lot about them, but also about the project.
Interesting. So, I mean, I'm assuming that you're kind of working on, you know, like bigger projects that are going over kind of a longer period of time, where the work that we're kind of doing, you know, we might get 3 or 4 new kind of projects a day and things are kind of always, you know, I guess, churning in that regard. And that's one of the kind of struggles that we've always had with kind of remote work is that, you know, we're kind of a bit of a hub. Things kind of come in. We always kind of need to kind of field that. What kind of tools and resources do you use that kind of really help facilitate, you know, remote work for you in this kind of role?
A lot of chat apps. So Slack is sort of the big standard right now. I use that a lot. It's sort of how I indicate I'm around and online. We have a lot of project management tools each team uses, but basically some place to put all of the to-do lists and any sort of attachments or specifications or links and things like that, make sure that's all in one place. I use spreadsheets and text documents all the time. I love a good organized spreadsheet. Not everyone can relate, which I understand, but I do that a lot for myself.
Well, yeah, we've been using Airtable recently. Have you checked that out?
I had a friend actually demoed that to me. It looks amazing. I have not used it myself.
It's amazing.
Oh my God.
Very much recommend.
Talk about good spreadsheets.
As a DPM, you will love it. Just thank us later.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the newsletter for a second, because obviously that is how he found you and how he sort of first related to you. So, I mean, I think one of the things I love about the newsletter so much is that obviously I'm not a DPM myself. I'm a producer and there's a lot of crossover, but I'm not strictly a DPM. But the newsletter definitely has almost all the ideas you put forward are pretty like everyday life ideas that also then relate to project management. And I wanted to just chat a bit more about why that relationship sort of interests you.
Oh, I'm glad it comes across that way, because that's definitely my goal. I think I found personally, the longer I've done project management, the more I've realized how relatable that is in like every aspect of my life. I've sort of inadvertently started project managing like family holidays and sort of how I like...
How does that look?
Well, usually I'll be the one to initiate asking everyone like what they want for Christmas. And then if there's something that we can all go in on, I'll facilitate the timing and ordering and getting everyone to pay up and all of that. And I really enjoy that.
You could really use the Airtable form feature, I can imagine. You'll figure it out when you get in there.
How do you, I mean, you know, speaking of this, I mean, it sounds, I mean, you know, there's obviously a lighter side to it, but there is kind of a similar aspect that is kind of serious, where it's like, well, not serious, but like getting other people who, you know, might not be that au fait with different tech and different systems, like, you know, getting them onboarded. And that's kind of one area of friction that I've always kind of found, like with new clients, like, you know, we have a very specific way of kind of doing things. We love using Basecamp. We've developed our own systems as well to kind of onboard clients and, you know, take them through the process. But I've also then, you know, had a lot of conversations with, you know, previous employees or other people who are like, yeah, like, you know, my boss won't integrate Slack, like just can't get them to do it. Like, and I know it's going to make them easier. There's always kind of everyone's, you know, or even just kind of something as email, like some people just only kind of want to keep things in email or only kind of, you know, do things a very specific way. How do you, when you need to kind of are working with a new team or on a new project, how do you get people as the manager of, I guess, of that project effectively to, you know, to come on into your kind of way of working if you have it down to kind of a bit of a science?
Oh, wow. That's a fantastic question. That's definitely a huge pain point. I think very, very like repetitive reminders and discussions. I contracted for a very long time and I felt a lot more confident sort of forcing my way on teams a lot of times because I was a hired expert and my way is a proven method. And so I would, you know, reiterate what I needed, especially for teams that, you know, needed that process. Sometimes I'll fit into a process that exists. But sort of, you know, reiterating what I need, making, you know, an email or guide of some sort, sort of showing how I use project management tools. So like what these statuses on these tasks mean, what I expect, making that clear, not necessarily, you know, assuming that people understand like acronyms or where things are if it's not clear and laid out somewhere. So I definitely appreciate a good onboarding process. And I think the same goes with like clients on projects. It's really hard for them to get used to a new routine or, you know, a new piece of technology or something if it's not part of their systems already. So it just makes sense to like lay out expectations, explain things as though, you know, not condescendingly, but as though it's someone's first time, because that can always be appreciated and referenced later, whether, you know, you knew at one point and you forgot 6 months later, or you never knew in the first place anyway. So I think it's really important to be like really clear and never make assumptions in that way.
Well, that kind of leads me into another question, which is, you know, something that I always like discussing in terms of how you deal with kind of different personalities, especially from the remote side of things. Again, like I'm so interested in this remote aspect. And I think, you know, what we're talking about, the mini links as well, one of the things from that Crack podcast on kind of mental health in social media was kind of all about how, you know, evolutionarily we are designed to be kind of facial recognition machines. So basically that we can read things in people's faces that we might not even be kind of conscious of, just all those kind of micro expressions to kind of read something, and how when all this communication happens kind of online, all of that kind of, you know, is effectively kind of gone. And that makes conflict arise, I think, so much easier. It's very conducive to kind of conflict as well. And, you know, we find, you know, that's why we try to get on the phone or in front of people kind of as much as possible. Everyone always has their kind of little bag of tricks, I suppose. One actual audiobook that I'm listening to at the moment is called Never Split the Difference, which is a negotiation book written by a former hostage negotiator. And I like kind of trying to bring those things, like, you know, into, you know, our life as producers. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, if you have a specific kind of bag of tricks or how you've trained yourself to deal with scenarios like that when they arise.
I'm a big advocate of getting to know people like as people, not just, you know, names and avatars or a part of a team. And that's personally helped me a lot. I read a lot out of like that personality and tone of voice and that kind of thing. Like you're saying, it's hard to get that over remote work. But I have found like there's all those jokes out there about, you know, someone answers a text with just okay or K and you're like, oh man, they must be mad. But there are people like I'm friends with people and, you know, I work with people who that's how they answer regardless of whether they're mad or not. So if you kind of get to know someone outside of the context of a specific project or a specific interaction, you just know them as a person, you can kind of realize like, okay, you know, they're someone who doesn't elaborate on words or they don't use emojis and that's totally their personality and everything's fine. And, you know, if they start acting different from that expectation, I know something might be up. So you kind of can get that sense of how someone communicates and that sort of shows off their personality. So that's helped me a lot. I think taking the time to address complicated or difficult issues as they come up in a really honest way helps too. No one likes to be sort of blindsided, especially remotely, you know, if someone's like, hey, what's up? And they, you know, you wait until that person responds to say like, hey, by the way, that task didn't go well. So giving them the chance to sort of respond and react to messages honestly and not like trying to force someone into a conversation and respecting that that sort of space in a remote way, if that makes any sense, is helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking of challenges, do you have a disaster story that you're able to share with us? I mean, we'd be so curious. I mean, you've obviously managed so many different projects and different teams over the years. And yeah, curious as to whether there was a time where something went wrong and how'd you learn from it? I feel like I'm interviewing you for a job right now.
What are your strengths?
Oh, the worst questions. No, I definitely have a disaster story. I feel like I've had quite a few. The good disasters are the ones you learn from. A few years ago, I was working with a mostly contractor based company, and we're all remote, and we took on a very creative project that was very exciting. It wasn't a great fit for us, and that wasn't necessarily clear or handled well from the start. And I was not involved in, you know, the sale of the project, which I think a lot of people can relate to, getting thrown into projects where the circumstances are sort of out of their control, but they need to make something out of it.
Yeah, you're kind of on the back foot to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. So we had kind of like oversold, underbid, and it was hard. And our style did not match the brand that we were working with. So the brand was very sort of Pinteresty, and I love that kind of stuff. So I was very excited, but our team didn't really have that aesthetic. So from the start, the design work was difficult. We went through a lot of rounds. The client side was going through a lot of staff changes throughout our project, which also made it sort of tense because that meant, you know, their capacity was changing. They couldn't always focus on the project. We weren't nailing it and they weren't happy. So they actually ended up pulling away and getting their own designer on the project. And then we took them back when that failed. And you can sort of see where it's like a little bit of red flags going on this whole time. So this was maybe like 6 or 9 months later. And we had set a launch date for around the holidays, which really wasn't a great idea. And we ended up, my team and I, we all ended up working through Thanksgiving, through most of Christmas, to be honest. And we didn't launch until after the new year. And within a year, they had already redesigned and redeveloped the site. After that, we saw, and it was just very tense because there was a lot of wasted overhead, not just in, you know, our time and hours and ruining the holidays with our families, but also obviously a lot of tension because we weren't nailing the design at first. Then we got the design from someone else and we were building it out and the designs weren't complete. And there was a lot of kind of gaps there where we were realizing we had to, you know, fill in all those blanks or go back to the design firm who had cut ties with the client and sort of get that. So there were just so many pieces, a lot of tension and a lot of team bonding time, but we did learn, so many things from that. We didn't take on a project like that in the future. We learned how to sort of parcel out all of the work in a more sustainable way to make sure we had clients sign off on what they're providing us after that. And it was a really, really big learning situation for everyone involved. It's unfortunate that it was such a disaster. And I can make fun of it now, but I was kind of ripping my hair out during the time. But I learned to be more.
We've all had those.
Yeah, you learn a lot. I've gained a lot of confidence in my strengths. At the time, I called every single issue that was going to happen essentially like 6 months beforehand. But I wasn't super confident in that at the time because I really wanted it to work. I was really optimistic, and so when I heard from the top down it was going to work because they just wanted to believe that, I was like, okay, sure. I'm wrong. and I wasn't, sadly.
So trust your instinct.
Natalie, speaking about learning, what do you think that we can do, as kind of producers as well, to kind of further this, this discussion and this whole idea of professional development within the broader talent base of producers and project managers? Because it's like one thing that I found that, one of our drivers for this podcast is like, we really want to talk with other people like yourself who, we felt like didn't really kind of have a huge voice, like in kind of, I guess, the media and press and kind of landscape of creative work, but yet the work that we do is kind of so important. And we've also found that, when we kind of talk to a lot of producers or other account managers, project managers, et cetera, that, a lot of the things that we find are really kind of, very basic. So it's like, there are certain kind of things that you can do. Obviously, some people do them better than others, but a lot of the kind of skills are kind of elementary common sense things that, not everyone can kind of get right, but people who are producer project managers seem to kind of excel at that. And I'm just kind of curious, like one reason that I really kind of like your newsletter is because you're bringing in things from and bringing discussions from other disciplines as well. But I'm just kind of curious, what do you think that either that we can do either as a podcast or as a business or in general, how can we keep up and further our own training? And how can we kind of continue this discussion in a way that's going to be beneficial, throughout the world?
That's a really great point. I think a lot of the value is in just having the discussion, which is like a little bit, I guess, of a cop-out answer. But like you said, like so much of this is common sense in what we do. And you would think that it's obvious or, easy to do, but most people don't realize the value or difficulty in that, in doing it and, doing this work in scenarios like a project or, if you're a freelancer, you kind of have to do this for yourself or any interaction where you're sort of project managing or producing or in charge of those more basic things, the value isn't always as obvious to other people. So having these discussions is really great so that, others realize how much is involved. You don't just have a conversation about budget. There's a lot of aspects involved and it's difficult at times. No one likes to hear that there needs to be more budget or no one likes to have that conversation or things like that. So I guess talking about it and sort of seeing how that applies in all the other things that you do in life or in general and recognizing sort of how far that spreads in your work and how you can apply those principles to your work or to everyday life and seeking out, I guess, more things to read or understand and apply to that work. I know there are a lot of more sort of technical ways to grow your skills, taking courses or getting certifications and things. But I think a lot of it is just in that human interaction aspect that can be refined by really understanding yourself and like understanding others a lot more.
Yeah, I agree. That sort of emotional intelligence is so crucial to what we do. Just to close out, I wanted to ask, you know, if you have any hot tips for people who are just sort of embarking on their project management career, any advice for how they should handle things or resources that they can look into?
Yeah, totally. I would say always ask questions. Someone told me that once and it's helped me throughout my whole career. Never be afraid to communicate something that might seem obvious. So even if stating, you know, something at the end of a meeting or call seems like it should be known, that always helps. Reading stuff about other disciplines. So I learned a lot about like meeting techniques and negotiating, just like language in my emails that have seemingly nothing to do with negotiation. You know, learning that from sales books and things, that's really helpful. And I would say there's a lot of amazing PM resources out there and they can help pretty much anyone. Ladder Than 10 has an awesome list on their website. That's ladderthan10.com/resources.
I think we've actually talked about that on the podcast before. So,
oh, nice. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, they're great. There's another newsletter out there that's almost all links called Make Better. That's by Holly Davis, and that's like delivery project management focused, but there's some really good stuff in there that weaves in sort of everything in real life. And those are some great resources too.
And also, you know, you did mention that, you know, these kind of conferences as well, like what happens there? Are those something that, you know, that you think people like us or other people, I guess, in the more traditional advertising design spheres would get a benefit from?
Totally. Actually, when you were talking about the newsletter earlier, that's exactly the reaction of like, oh, someone understands me. That's exactly the reaction I've had every time I've gone to like a PM focused conference. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like a giant therapy session. The DPM Summit is really awesome. I know they have some talks online as well now. There are a lot of other smaller project management focused conferences out there sort of coming up regionally. And I know there are some meetups and things, and just connecting with other people who do what you do is so motivating and inspiring. And I never really had that before. So I was like shocked to realize that when I first became a part of the digital project manager community.
Is that something that you think you gravitated towards when you started working from home?
A little bit. It was just before that. And I think it motivated me to go and do freelance work. I was working at a position where I was doing some really cool stuff in a marketing department, but it just wasn't for me. I wasn't really managing any traditional projects. And I missed a lot of that busyness in an agency. And I found the digital project manager community like on blogs and on Twitter. And I remembered what I loved about what I do. And it sort of encouraged me to look for more work on the side while I had the time. And I ended up going freelance full time from that. And it really did sustain me while I was working from home and remote too. And it's become one of the biggest resources I have available to me, just having these people who know what I do. And I don't need to go seek them out. They're all right there.
That's fantastic. Speaking of which, where can people find more about you, subscribe to your newsletter and your Tumblr as well, which we didn't highlight, which is kind of our favorite thing in the world. Can you give us a bit of a rundown of the links and of your internet presence?
Sure. Yeah. The newsletter can be found at dpmish.com. It goes out weekly every Friday morning. It's quickly approaching 1 year of that. My personal website is talkanatalka.com.
What does that mean?
We've debated this in the office before.
Oh, really? Oh, man. It's a play on my childhood nickname. I'm Ukrainian, and so Natalie in Ukrainian is Natalka, and growing up, everyone called me Talka. So it's been like my internet handle for a long time now.
Very nice.
Yeah. I've thought about changing it. It is a little confusing, but... That's my personal site, and you can find more blogs and stuff there. And then the Tumblr is pmreactions.com. I haven't updated in a while, but I think that this will motivate me to do it because it gives me life on rough days.
It gives us life as well. Don't worry.
Love it. Natalie, thank awesome. You so much for your time. That's really insightful. I really encourage anyone who listens to this and is interested in the things that we talk about to immediately subscribe to Natalie's letter. Do you have any parting words that you'd like to communicate to our audience?
Oh, I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening and just keep asking questions and communicating and submit some animated GIFs to PM Reactions.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Natalie. Best of luck with the new job and look forward to keeping in touch.
Awesome.
Wrapping up like we like to do every week is the most Melbourne and most New York thing we've seen this week. Lara, I know your head is fully in Hawaii zone at the moment, but what's the most Melbourne thing that you've seen this week?
Well, it's funny because I think probably like both of you as well, I usually spend my commute to work on podcast recording day like trying to think like shit, I need a Melbourne thing, like what have I seen? And I mean, I don't know if it's a particular, it feels pretty Melbourne to me, but the Lord or whoever the AI gods handed down something this morning. I stepped on the train and there was a dude just like lying on the floor of the train by the doors. He wasn't like passed out or something. He was not having like a stroke or anything. He was just lying like with his hands behind his head, like lying. And people getting onto the train, they weren't saying anything. They were literally just stepping over him. Like that was a normal, fine thing to do. And I sort of, I'm in a dress, so I didn't want to step over him. So I sort of walked around him weirdly and like stepped over his feet, but he just lay on the floor for the entire time. And I really tried to get a photo, but it was just too obvious.
He was chilling
in a very inconvenient place.
Bianca, speaking of inconvenient places.
Well, I got out of New York this week and spent a few days with some friends in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania for the Super Bowl, which was perhaps the most American thing that I have seen and experienced in.
Yeah, we made a lot of fun of you on the podcast that you were.
I am coming up to 2 years in New York and my assimilation is complete. I mean, seeing the Eagles win the Super Bowl was pretty.
The
Super Bowl.
That's the sports game.
The sports ball. I mean, that was pretty exciting. Most valuable player was the bartender at the Irish pub that we were at, who just somehow swiftly just ducked in and out of like hundreds of drunken revelers all in like Eagles jerseys and kept the place running, which was incredible. Can't say so much for the city, which kind of descended into chaos immediately after the game.
Yeah, I saw all the like smashed department store windows and stuff. It's pretty hectic.
No, yeah, fireworks.
My Melbourne thing is based on the internet, because that is where I live. And that's kind of, we spoke about, you know, some of our art crushes from last year on our 2017 wrap up. And I mentioned Tom Blatchford for his Midnight Modern series of photographs from Palm Springs. But he's also just announced a new series, which is called Nihon Noir, which is kind of similar to his Palm Spring projects, but all done in Tokyo. And they are just phenomenal.
Oh my God, these are so Blade Runner-esque.
Yeah, they're. And yeah, so the timing is amazing. Tom, a Melbourne-based photographer, it's a very Melbourne thing as well. But yeah, like we're going to post a link to this in our show notes, because it's definitely something you want to kind of check out. So yeah, good work, Tom.
Oh, wow, they're beautiful.
And yeah, keep on keeping on.
I opened the link a little late, but they're beautiful.
I know, they're amazing. Thank you so much, Bianca.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lara.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz, and you can subscribe to our podcast-specific newsletter with all of our show notes and links to our episode downloads every Friday at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/jackiewinter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details are on our website, jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. I'm also just realizing I take the longest to ask questions.
Like that,
so, yeah,
thank you for being patient. That always asks the question at the end of a lecture. That just
oh, come on, they're not that bad, Bianca.
The mature age student.
I just it just takes me a while to get to my point, because, you know, it's very subtle.